So this is work. Some of it is a little bit old. So I'll be saying some of that, mostly with Ira Rothstein at Carnegie Mellon, and some newer stuff with a postdoc of mine, Andy Ross, and with Ira Ross. And the basic thing, or the what I'll be discussing, is astrophysical black holes and other compact objects, let's say neutron stars, placed in gravitational fields that are much larger than their Schwarzschild radius. For instance, the field of another black hole that's in orbit around the thing we're talking about, but they're far enough apart. The reason why I'm going to be talking about this stuff is because, I'll try to explain that there's a natural formulation of these systems in terms of effective field theories, where you sort of disentangle the different scales and treat them one at a time. So it's interesting from a field theory point of view, but it's actually also experimentally relevant. It's got something to do with experiments that are, well, LIGO is running. LISA might run at some point, but there are experiments that are feasible in the future, at some point in the future. So before I get into the details of the field theories that I'm going to be looking at, let me give you some of the main motivation. And so what we're going to be looking at is a particularly important class of signals for gravity wave detectors like LIGO and LISA. And these are signals that consist of a pair of compact objects, like neutron stars or black holes, in orbit, still moving non-relativistically relative to each other, let's say distances of, 100 kilometers apart. And these are and spiraling and losing energy due to gravitational radiation. And these are incredibly important. This is the bread and butter of these gravity wave detectors that are either currently running or in the planning stages. And there's three reasons why they're so important. Number one, you can actually hope to see them. They're strong emitters of gravitational radiation. If you plug in the basic numbers, like the mass of a neutron star and the separation of order 100 kilometers, you get a signal that LIGO can hope to see out to pretty far out, so out to the Hubble scale or something. At least for the version of LIGO that's in the works, not the one that's running. Because you can see so far out, hopefully, you expect a lot of these events to happen per year, a lot of these in-spiral events to happen per year. And because of that, you'll have tons of data eventually. Not right now. These are sort of the rate per year. Sorry, I don't want to kill you. Not right now. These are sort of the current LIGO rates. They're pretty small, but the upgraded LIGO in 5 years or so might expect to see many of these in-spiral events, say from neutron stars coalescing into each other, or neutron star and black hole, and so on. So eventually, large number of events. And the last reason why these guys are important and useful is because the signal lasts a long amount of time in the detector. So what does that mean? Well, let's just sort of do the order of magnitude, let's say for LIGO. I'll use LIGO numbers. LISA, the dynamics in LISA is more or less the same scaled up because the frequency band is different. But we can talk about LIGO, and we can just do a crude estimate of the dynamics just using the good old Newtonian physics. So the typical velocity is related to the typical radius by this usual formula. We're talking about objects that emit gravitational waves in the LIGO band. LIGO band, let's take it to be between 10 and a kilohertz. And if you plug in the numbers, you get for a neutron star that when this thing enters the LIGO band, when this in-spiraling object enters the LIGO band, they start out a few hundred kilometers apart, and eventually they coalesce because they're emitting waves, and then they might get pretty close, like 14 kilometers. And by comparison, the Schwarzschild radius of a solar mass object is a kilometer. We're talking about neutron stars with a radius about 10 kilometers, mass of order a solar mass, or let's say black holes with mass of order 10 solar masses. So by the end of the band, this thing is pretty close to coalescence. And if you look, you can also understand the thing in terms of velocities rather than radii. And so they start out fairly slow relative to the speed of light. And then they get pretty damn close, and eventually they just smack into each other, and they're right at the speed of light. Or close to it. So that's the scales of the problem. We can also understand the amount of time that it takes this event, this in spiral, to sweep through the band of the detector. Again, we can just use sort of the leading order just to get an estimate. Use the crude, the quadruple formula in general relativity, which basically the rate of energy loss, of mechanical energy loss, goes like that. If you just plug in, it radiates like the quadruple moment. So if you just plug things in, you get a formula like that. You integrate that guy, you get that. It takes about order minutes to go from 10 hertz to however many it was, a kilohertz. And the number of events and the number of cycles that it sweeps through as it spans that band is huge. It's like it goes down like 1/5. The velocities are small initially, and so it's like 10^4 radians of phase that the thing sweeps through during the evolution of the system. And so what that means for these experiments, and I'm not going to get into the whole stuff about how to extract these signals and match filters and all this stuff. But what it basically means is that the experiments are actually highly sensitive to relativistic corrections. Basically because if you have a template, sort of a model for what the signal looks like, if you were to run it in time, if it were to go out of phase with the observed number of cycles by a little bit, if it were out of phase by a little bit, after you run it for all this time, it would go out of phase by order of one amount. So you can really tune the template that you use, and in fact, it's been worked out a long time ago, that the dynamics the experiment is actually sensitive, not just to this leading order, sort of pseudo-Newtonian dynamics, but it's actually sensitive to relativistic corrections from general relativity, of order v over c to the 6. So very, very, very sensitive to relativistic dynamics. And so because of that, one might hope to use these things to test classical GR very well.
Are the calculations to that order? Excuse me? Are the calculations, are predictions to that order?
Some, yes.
Okay.
So you have to do the calculus. So you don't have to do the detective, but to really extract all the information in the signal, it's good to have it in this order. And if you do, you might ask yourself, well, what can you get out of it? And you can get stuff like parameters in the binary system, like masses, what the spins are, how far away they are, out to a large sort of cosmological scale distance, as I just said a little bit, because you're testing. You're really testing, I mean, it's not fully nonlinear, it's not numerical. I'm just talking about stuff that's can be done analytically. But you can go pretty far out in nonlinear gravitational effects. And part of the question that I'm going to be answering is how far out. So going up to velocity to the sixth, what order, how many terms in the Einstein Lagrangian when you expand on that linearized gravity do you have to keep, for example? Finally, and it's a question mark, and it's also something I'll talk about, can you, for instance, at some order, does the fact that the thing is a black hole or a neutron star affect the signal? How does that come in? So those are things that you would like to know. And so this is really the motivation or the physics motivation, sort of the party line for studying these systems. And I gave you LIGO numbers for LIGO has more or less the same story, except scale and frequency, because it's sort of a complementary frequency. So it's sensitive to similar types of objects, except scaled up. Yeah.
You have a thousand megaparsecs. What do you mean by this?
That's how far out the signal is. So the signal decays like 1/r. So
you're getting into cosmological.
Sure.
Cluster scale.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have to worry about whether you're dark matter or not.
Okay, I don't know. I mean, I assume that it's just a standard matter-dominated FRW. I'm not worried about that aspect of it. I'm worried about what's going on in the binary.
But some people suggest you can use this as a standard candle.
Yeah, that's right.
Can I ask a question about the frequency? You have an inspiring system.
Yes.
So would the frequency be peaked at the frequency of the inspire?
Of the orbit? Yeah, absolutely. It tracks it.
And so why are we talking 10 hertz then?
So it starts at an orbital, so the orbit, the period is 1 over 10 hertz.
So we're really right up against each other.
Yeah. Well, at that point, they're like about hundreds of kilometers apart, which is much faster than Hall's Taylor or something like that.
So if they're 100 kilometers apart, you'd see a 10 hertz signal.
Yeah. That's right.
That's well.
Yeah.
When the black holes coalesce, presumably they also have lots of material around them.
Junk, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, is there anything in the visible radius?
Yeah. You mean like electromagnetic stuff?
Yeah.
Probably. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, there's probably some sort of astrophysical environment, but whether the signal from the coalescence has any electromagnetic stuff, I doubt it, actually.
But far away, probably hard to see.
Yeah, it'd be hard to see. It's not clean. I mean, this is incredibly clean. It's just hard to detect. Right, this is pure gravity. I'm only going to be talking about gravitation.
And also, when the black holes coalesce, that's fine. It's a nice problem. But when the neutrons start coalescing,
that's a mess.
That's a mess, right?
So nobody really knows how to do that. I mean, the part I'm going to be talking about is purely analytical. So everything is more or less under control. You're asking about the numerical stuff. Numerical simulations of black holes have gotten better over the last couple of years. One hears the word revolution sometimes, that the codes have gotten much better. Now they can evolve numerically these black holes over multiple orbits. But for neutron stars, how would they know, right? How would they know how to do it? But anyway, I'm interested in the sort of the clean part of the problem, the analytical, purely gravitational part of the problem, if that was sort of your question. Okay? All right, so that was sort of the party line motivation for studying this. The reason why I got into this is because it's actually, well, to me, it's an interesting field theory problem. It's a problem that has several length scales playing a role simultaneously in the problem. And so here's my crappy cartoon of that. Here's, let's say, two black holes in orbit around each other. And there's three scales. There's the size of the object itself, there's the orbital scale r, and the wavelength of the radiation that these objects emit as they orbit and coalesce. And if you look at all these scales in the non-relativistic limit, where they're still fairly far apart, all these different scales are correlated with each other. First of all, the Schwarzschild radius is related to the orbital scale by Kepler's law, or the virial theorem, whatever you want to call it. Is gm over r, v squared is gm over r, so the orbital scale is correlated with the radius of the black hole. And it's non-relativistic, so you can multiple expand, and the wavelength of the radiation is characteristic of the orbital scale, again, related to the orbital scale by a power of v, where v is the typical velocity. So it's because of that I find this problem interesting. But it's also a source of complications for sort of the conventional, what are called post-Newtonian methods for solving this problem as a perturbation series in the velocity parameter. The velocity is less than one, and at least for the numbers that I showed you, it starts at like 10 to the minus 2 and ends up being order of 1. So for most of the evolution, it's a pretty good expansion parameter. So there are mature methods for dealing with this sort of calculations, but they run into trouble if you go to high enough order. There's divergences and ambiguities in calculations, and some of them come from the fact that you're modeling these objects not as balls of fluid, like a neutron star or an actual finite-sized black hole, but as a delta function. So that leads you to some, in a sense, what I guess it's everything's classical, but it's a short distance divergence, let's call it an ultraviolet divergence. And there's ambiguities not ambiguities, but there's also long distance divergences having to do with the fact that basically you're dealing with massless particles, gravitons, even though everything's purely classical. And so you know, some of these have been dealt with, some of them are not so clear. And so what I want to discuss is sort of an alternative way to do this, where you can it's sort of a clearer way physically of doing this, in which all these scales are disentangled one at a time. And if you have something like that, then you can sort of hope to understand the origin of all sorts of divergences you might have, and you would know exactly how to renormalize them and what sort of physical effects they give. And so the tool I'm going to use is a language of effective field theory. And so what I'm going to try to do for all of this talk is really to recast this problem as an effective field theory problem, where you basically integrate out one scale at a time, everything at the classical level, but you can still use this language. And then the usual effective field theory technology sort of helps you understand different aspects of the binary problem. So, for instance, you can renormalize the theory in terms of Wilson coefficients, if you like. If there's logs, and there are, but I don't think I'll get to talk about this. I don't think I'll have time. But if there's logs, the logs are typically logs of scale ratios, and in this problem, scale ratios are powers of the velocity. So you can understand logarithms of the velocity using RG methods, and so on.
So what do you mean by integrate out?
Hopefully that will become clearer as I go along. But I mean, in a sense, remove short distance degrees of freedom and absorb them into coefficients of a long distance theory. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that. But you know, maybe you can ask me again if it's. So I mean, this is the cartoon version sort of what I mean by integrating out. And what I mean is that what you're trying to model really is certain extended objects coupled to gravity, so black holes or neutron stars. And so what I want to do in a sense is simplify the problem by taking the internal structure and sort of encoding it. Let's say you have a single black hole, for example, right? You take the fact that it has a finite size, and you just treat it as a point particle, but it's not just a point particle. It's a point particle plus small deviations from point particle behavior. And the way those small deviations show up is as local terms and some Lagrangian sort of non-minimal couplings. So basically what I want to do is sort of remove that structure, put it in a point particle Lagrangian where it's simpler to deal with. Then you look at the system at even longer distances, And now at longer distances, you can sort of average over the orbital scale. And when you average over the orbital scale, you can multiple expand and sort of absorb all the structure of the two-body problem into a single multiple object coupled to gravity. And sort of doing this, it's basically the multiple expansion. This integrate, I mean, classically, it's the multiple expansion. What makes it hard in GR is that the multiples couple to each other because the theory is nonlinear. So that's something that wouldn't happen in a magnet system.
Einstein gravity is intrinsically nonlinear.
Yeah.
So this is why you can't add two spatial solutions.
Of course.
So
you're trying to perturb. So my two Schwarzschild black holes are far. So to zeroth order is just a sum, but I'm interested in the corrections away from how to handle that systematically. So I'm trying to find, in a sense, although I wouldn't use those variables, the metric of two black holes orbiting each other. That's basically what I'm trying to do. It has an expansion in their relative velocity.
Unfortunately, GR satisfies the Birkhoff theorem.
Right.
So you don't have to worry about Marx principle. Okay. So you start bringing in the...
I usually don't worry about Max principle anyway.
But some of us do.
I know it's going to do with rotating buckets or something. I'm sorry. Anyway, this is a cartoon version of what I'm trying to do. And now I want to fill this out with details. So at every point, at every stage, so I'm going to build a chain of what I'm going to call effective field theories, which is basically the multiple expansion, but accounting for the nonlinearities and gravity. And at each point, I'm looking at basically at some sort of composite object with a bunch of moments just living on it. So as some sort of particle that has a bunch of degrees of freedom right on top of it, some sort of normal modes. And the way you classify those normal modes is in terms of quantum numbers in the rotation group, multiples. For instance, if you have a star is made up of some field theory, like a fluid is a field theory, or gravity, like a black hole, gravity is a field theory. And what you do is you just decompose the fields in that field theory into modes, and they satisfy some eigenvalue problem. And basically, you just, in a sense, dimensionally reduce. So you're looking at this object at long distances, and so you basically just have, at long distances, these things are just a bunch of multiple. Just to give you an example of what I'm talking about, we can look at the multiple moments of a black hole, of a Schwarzschild black hole. And it has a bunch of zero frequency modes. If you solve the wave equation for gravitational perturbations about the background, three of them are easy. The massless ones are easy to identify. There's a scalar mode, which just corresponds to the mass of the object. If you just shift the mass of a black hole in the metric, that's like a zero mode. You plug into the wave equation, it just gives you zero. It's a zero eigenvalue. Another one would be the translational zero modes, the fact that you can move the black hole around and it doesn't cost any energy to do that. And finally, there is the spin of the object itself. If you spin it up, it doesn't cost any energy to do that. Those are the massless modes. Then on top of that, it has a bunch of what I'm going to call massive or, sort of finite frequency modes, but frequency is like a mass. So finite frequency modes, an infinite number of them for every multiple. On top of these zero modes, there's all these guys, and they all have a width. They're not really normal modes. They're what are called quasi-normal modes. They can decay. They can decay into radiation. And so I guess I took this from some paper, and this is all in units of the Schwarzschild radius. Well, in these units, these are the units of these numerical people. But that's the internal structure. That's what I mean by this cartoon, that you basically solve for these modes. And most of these modes will be completely irrelevant when I look at the system at long distances.
If you included the quasi-normal, would you have to add a degree of freedom on the world?
So when you start out, you basically write down the degree of freedom for every single quasi-normal mode. So you have all of them. But then I'm going to look at the thing at long wavelengths, and most of them will be totally irrelevant because I can't excite them, right? I don't have the frequency, say it's interacting with gravitational radiation, it's just far off resonance. It's not gonna excite that mode.
So how would you describe that degree of freedom?
It would just be like a multiple moment as a function of time, living on the world line of a point particle. So what a black hole becomes to me is like a point particle with a bunch of harmonic oscillators sitting on top of it. And the harmonic oscillators have transformal rotation. And that's what all these guys are. Alright, most of these modes are going to not be excited, so I might as well remove them from the theory, and this is what I mean by integrate them out. I don't have the resolution to observe them, but they do play a small role. And the role they play is to make you can treat a black hole as just an effective point particle, but it's not exactly a minimally coupled point particle. There's extra terms having something to do with the structure, with this internal structure. So at long distances, I could basically just ignore all those modes, write down an effective Lagrangian that couples gravity to ordinary gravity to this black hole, for example. I don't even have to know what these modes are. I know from just the symmetries of the problem what sort of terms they can give me. I know that the symmetries are, it's just general covariance. So So I just write down all terms allowed by general covariance. And you know, the first one is just the usual point particle mass term. Then there's couplings to the curvature, and I chose a nice operator basis to write the curvature in terms of electric and magnetic parities. It doesn't really matter. It's just curvature squared terms. Anything that's linear in the curvature has to involve the Ricci curvature. And I can just get rid of those terms by making field redefinitions. So these are really the leading terms you get. And these coefficients, so if you don't know the internal structure, you don't know what these coefficients are. But any object, like let's say a neutron star or a black hole, will look like this. With the difference between a black hole and a neutron star, as far as I'm concerned, is what these numbers are.
So couldn't you have a velocity of the black hole here? Like,
It doesn't show up at this order.
Because I can imagine you can contract dx mu.
I forgot exactly why. I think it's just because of the identities involving these terms these are purely, I forget exactly why, but yes, you can have such terms, but they just don't show up at this order. But the rule of the game is you write down everything that's allowed by covariance.
So you're adding both intrinsic terms in the curvature and extrinsic. You have both derivatives along the world line and also normal.
Yeah, so all that stuff is there. And anything that's allowed by it. Anything that you can write down that's generally covariant or a scalar living on a world line, you just write it down.
This is where I was getting confused because it's problematic writing down an action for a brain or particle or whatever and adding the normal derivatives.
Okay. Well, maybe we can talk about that later.
Maybe it doesn't show up here.
Maybe the problems are things like short distance divergences that just get renormalized by adding more of these terms, you know? So maybe it's not, in a sense, maybe it's a problem that gets cured by adding more of these things.
I thought the normal derivatives were correlated with higher derivatives involved.
That's right, yeah. But he's not adding higher derivatives.
But that may be why he didn't have to write them in the brain either, so they should come together.
Oh, you're saying it's sort of the variational problem in bulk. Is that what you're...
Yeah, the variational problem in the bulk ties together how many normal derivatives you're like.
I see. But this is not really a boundary for the space, right? This is just a bulk. So maybe...
It's not a boundary, no, but it's still... Well, maybe that's how you get around it.
Yeah, I don't know. We can talk more about it.
Is that like the self-energy? Or...
So, kind of question: black hole is not a neutron star.
Right.
And all the matters are for zero. Singularity. The horizon is a mathematical thing. It's not something you can bang against.
Oh, sure.
So, what do you talk about the moments?
Well, I mean, this is a well-defined calculation. I mean, these moments are solutions of the linearized wave equation around the black hole background. I don't care what words you associate with them, but I mean, these are the normal modes of a black hole. If you take a hammer to a black hole, whatever that means, it's going to vibrate with those frequencies.
I'm trying to take a hammer to a black
hole. You can toss in a mass and see how it responds.
Yeah.
That's hitting it.
Yeah.
That's hitting with a hammer. When you collision, it means you have two horizons form into one. And numerically, we can now finally see that.
Some magic goes on, never mind.
It's not magic.
It's
a bunch
of
waveforms.
It's a matter of interpretation.
As far as the higher derivative terms in the bulk versus the ones in the brain,
yeah,
you're keeping four derivative terms on the world line.
Yes.
Is it what's the thing that controls the
expansion parameter?
Yeah, in the bulk as opposed to on the world line.
So the bulk, I'm assuming that it's purely classical gravity, right? So maybe there's deviations from classical gravity. I would guess that the thing that suppresses those operators is the Planck scale. What suppresses operators on the world line is the size of the object. So I can work in a limit where it's only, you know, let's just assume that it's root gr gravity. And there's all kinds of terms here, and I can even show you how these terms scale with the radius of the black hole, for example, if you want. I mean,
You're going to tell us that.
I'm going to show you that. Okay. I think maybe the next slide. Yep, I am going to show you that in the next slide. So as far as long distances is concerned, this is the difference between a black hole and a neutron star. So how do you calculate these numbers? And I'm going to give you sort of a thought experiment way of calculating. This might not be the most efficient way of doing it, but at least to me, it's sort of a nice, unambiguous gauge invariant way of presenting how you would do it. And so one way that you know that long distance modes are sensitive to this thing is that if you scatter a graviton off of a black hole, a two black hole graviton Compton scattering, just elastic scattering, it's going to know about these coefficients in sort of the long distance theory. So I can calculate a scattering amplitude to scatter a wave of a black hole. I can do it in this sort of truncated version of a black hole, and I can compare it to what you would get for a real black hole. So in the effective theory, you just calculate scattering off of this point object. And this is an operator with four derivatives on them. And so the amplitude scales like frequency to the fourth, and it's proportional to these coefficients. And so when you square up the amplitude to get a cross section, integrate over phase space, you're going to get a term. You're going to get interference of this with sort of scattering off the 1/r potential produced by the point mass and stuff. But you'll also get a term which will go just like the square of this particular term, and it goes like frequency to the eighth, and it's proportional to these coefficients squared. So that's sort of the effective theory calculation of some observable like this cross section, this elastic scattering cross section. And in the full theory, actually, it's something that has not been done, as far as I know, at least to the order that I would be interested in. So I don't know the answer, but I know how it scales with the radius of the black hole, because I know just from dimensional grounds that the scattering of a low frequency graviton by a black hole has to just go like, well, short shell radius, that's the only scale in the problem, and some function of this dimensionless quantity. If my effective theory is a good description of the long distance behavior of a black hole at all, then this has to be analytic. Maybe there's some logs and stuff, but it has to be analytic. It has to be about zero frequency. So if you expand it out, and if my theory is supposed to reproduce a black hole, the effective theory as a term goes like omega to the eight. The black hole calculation should have a term like that too. Just by dimensional analysis, it goes like the size to the 10th power. And just by comparing the two, I can read off, again, the calculation has not been done, so I don't know the exact numerical coefficient. But at least I know how the effective theory coefficients scale like the size of the object, and it's actually a pretty big power. It scales like size to the 5. So these terms are pretty highly suppressed, it turns out. You might anticipate that if you put this in a binary star, the only other scale is the size of the object, then it goes like velocity to the 10. So it's way suppressed. That's at least for a black hole. It turns out that this scaling with radius, it goes like to the 5th power. It's actually, if you do it like for a simple model, like a rubber ball scattering off of a graviton, like a Newtonian rubber ball, it actually also goes like radius to the 5. And I think people expect that to be true also of neutron stars. The point I'm trying to make is that it's incredibly sensitive. It goes like the 5th power of the radius. So even though it might be suppressed for a black hole, or an object like a neutron star, it could start competing with relativistic effects. And a neutron star is bigger than a black hole, let's say by a factor of 10, and the thing goes like radius to the 5th power. So you could get a possible enhancement. And GR people have looked at how large a signal that is.
You need to know what f is?
I do need to know what it is to get the exact coefficient. And it's actually not known to this order. You would have to solve the scattering problem. So it's basically finding a scattering wave function in a black hole background. Nobody's done it to this high order. They've done it to a leading order. And leading order, you can reproduce just by scattering of a Coulomb potential, basically. Yeah. So it's not very useful.
But if it's if some power of omega RS, then I don't see how you can get the scaling, right? I mean, if it's if F is just its argument to some power, could it be?
F is argument to some power.
Yeah, F is just.
Omega. Oh yeah, but yeah, but see then so it's I forget what power it starts at. In fact, it might start like 1/(ω). I don't remember, okay. But my point is that it better be expandable at zero frequency, just because, you know, if this effective, I mean, it's an assumption. If the effective theory is a good description of a black hole, then it better be analytic about zero energy, because that's what the effective theory predicts.
So you think it goes to a constant that's only goes to zero? Is that what you're
yeah, saying? I think that's in fact true, at least for scattering of scalar waves. I don't remember the answer. But
that's the assumption in this.
It's supposed to be analytic about zero momentum. And if it isn't, then a point particle with higher dimensional terms can describe a black hole at all. And everything is way more interesting than what I'm going to talk about. But I think that's all my all right, so that's how you figure out the scaling of these coefficients, if you have them.
Is there a physical argument as to why it goes like that power? I mean, in the same sense, if I look at energies of atoms, and you know, if I want to know how that.
Yeah, I think that's right.
It's like the you know Thomson photon gathering by particle, right? But now you have. The difference is a quadrupole, so it's like.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That's what those terms mean, basically. That's what you get for sort of integrating up the quadrupole to get these. So the quadrupole, so if I were to write down a theory with moments on it, right, sort of a world line theory that has moments, if you would have some oscillator, some quadrupole. And the only thing you could couple to is the curvature. So at least in the rest frame, it will look something like that. So it's sort of the analog in electrodynamics of P dot E, where P is the dipole moment. So this is sort of the gravity analog of the electric field. And basically, you're exciting that. That's what you know. But I am it, so I'm saying this point is massive, so I'm integrating it out. Uh-huh. And when I do that, I basically get R. It's two-point function, if you like, R, and this goes like 1/(some number). I don't know, call it some frequency, and so you get this R squared type operator, like the one I have there. I'm calling it E there, but it's E is really this is stuff.
That mode I should think of the thing, if I did that in your harmonic expansion, that's some mode which is kind of localized around the black hole.
It's not quite localized, it has a width, so it's kind of like an alpha particle, you know, in a square well potential, more than really a bound state.
Yeah.
But this particular example with the scattering of gravity must have been solved.
Has not been done.
I mean, this is
at least analytically, at least in the low frequency.
An analog of electromagnetic wave comes to a free particle, right?
It's
oscillating with the frequency.
That's exactly what it is.
It needs a dipole radiation according to Thomson.
Yeah. Well, it hasn't been done. It hasn't been done for a black hole.
For the black hole, for the sort of small intensity.
As far as I know,
radiation comes in, start moving around the particle.
Yeah, I understand. That's the physical effect. I mean, I agree with you. That's the physics. But I don't know where the formula is.
I would think it's been done. Right?
You would.
People.
You would. I looked for it. I couldn't find it.
I put the rubber ball instead of not plus done and it's reasonable.
Excuse me?
Put the rubber ball.
The rubber ball?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's well known. The rubber ball
So that's basically a scattering of gravitational wave off a rubber ball. That's an easier problem, I guess.
Yeah. So in that case, it's anyway, that's sort of the first stage in that hierarchy that I showed you before. And so that basically takes care of the internal structure of each object. And now I can just simulate them in a sense by a Lagrangian like this. One for each particle inside of my bound state. So I have a bound state with two black holes in it. You just put down one of these for each. And now I want to calculate some gravitational wave of servos out of that theory. So we want to calculate things that these gravitational wave detectors can see. How do we do that? Well, it actually requires just two input functions, two quantities that are sensitive to the orbital dynamics, at least in some limit, that's what they require. If you know the gravitational binding energy of the binary system as a function of the orbital parameters, and you know the instantaneous power radiated in gravitational waves as a function of the parameters, then you can use sort of an energy balance condition saying that the change in the mechanical energy, the loss of mechanical energy is due to gravity wave flux. And using that, you can integrate this equation to obtain the phase of the gravitational wave amplitude or the gravitational wave profile as a function of time, or if you like, as a function of the frequency in which you're looking at this. So here's an example, at least for a black hole, for a particle orbiting a black hole. It's a similar formula. But the point I want to make here is that all observables that I'm interested in can be obtained from these two quantities. So I'm interested in setting up perturbation theory for this problem. Basically what I want to do is I want to set up everything in terms of Feynman diagrams, just because, well, first of all, because I know how to calculate. They are sort of, even though I'm doing a classical physics problem, that whole technology is still useful. And so what I like to do is basically obtain the two observables I just mentioned purely in terms of Feynman diagrams. So I'm going to use quantum language, but everything I do is classical, and I can obtain both of those observables from one single quantity. So let me calculate sort of the gravitational analog of a Wilson loop, if you like. So what I'm going to calculate is basically I take two of these particles moving in they're moving in some orbit, and what I'm going to do is I'm just going to hold that orbit fixed and integrate out the graviton fluctuations around that system. Calculate the effective action for those point particles. And just do it in an expansion about the flat metric, but keep all nonlinear terms in the Lagrangian. So you do that. This has a standard expansion in terms of Feynman diagrams. In terms of Feynman diagrams, actually, that stay connected. So here's the particles, and they're exchanging gravitons of all sorts, and there's nonlinear terms from the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrange and all that stuff. It turns out that this quantity here can be expanded in these sort of Feynman diagram topologies, the ones that stay connected when these lines are removed. So.
Maybe you have a funny convention where external lines aren't really lines, right?
No, it's a real funny convention. Every time I give this talk, I get asked about that convention. What those lines really are insertions of sources.
Yeah.
Classical sources, which are basically the leading order, they're just the delta functions where the particles are sitting.
So the second graph there was really just really the Y-shaped graphic line with the next thing.
Yeah, so there's no, you shouldn't read a, there's no profit over there, right? It's just source. That's why those are the ones you keep.
Yeah. Why do you use that convention?
So I don't understand what's the problem. So why is this different from?
It's not, so if you were looking at Tess and Schroeder, for example, you would say, oh, this is like fermion scattering or particle scattering, and then you would put a 1 over p slash minus m in here, or something like that. I'm not doing scattering with objects that can fluctuate. I'm doing scattering of just classical sources. So there's no propagator there. It's just a source included here. Yeah, I don't know what we start to make. I guess we like the particle. There's nothing deep about it.
So if you press that particle.
Yeah.
Just explain, so the second, if you think of your sources, the second diagram is what? You still got two sources.
I have two sources, but now I have to insert sources at every one of these external points. I have to insert a source.
Oh, there's three sources.
There's three sources in that. So I just keep iterating more and more sources.
Oh, so it's like expansion of the generating function.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. I'm calculating a generating function, except that the sources, well, first of all, there's more than one type of source because you keep expanding out. You get more and more terms from the point particle that runs, and each one of those terms is a source. And each one of those sources is correlated with the world line of each particle. So it's a function of the world line.
Since you're doing positive integrals, are you going to worry about phase fixing?
You would. No, absolutely. Yeah, I have to define my propagator. There's no ghost because everything I do is really. Basically, if you're doing things that are classical, you just keep tree graphs. So you can't have sort. You can't have ghosts. Ghosts only appear in loops. But I do have to gauge fix. I have to add a
gauge
fix. Yeah. So that's the expansion. That's how you calculate this quantity. And I said before that you can get the observables from knowing the energy, the mechanical energy, and the radiated energy. And the beauty is that this actually has all that stuff. So this effective Lagrangian has a real part, and that real part is a function of the positions of the particles after I integrate out gravity. And so you can just extremize that Lagrangian to get classical equations of motion. And using the classical equations of motion, you can find the conserved energy, all that stuff. So that's one of the observables, the energy of the system. This action also has an imaginary part. The imaginary part it tells you the lifetime of this configuration. So this is an unstable system. I'm artificially holding these world lines apart, and if I were to let them go, they would just decay to zero. They would coalesce. And so that instability is reflected in the fact that there's an imaginary part. There's a width. The width is the rate for graviton emission from the system. Graviton emission is not a classical observable because you have to be able to resolve gravitons. But if you know the rate, you can certainly get classical stuff like power distributions just by multiplying by energy. So the upshot is that this action has everything. It has both the energy and the power emitted, and I can use it to calculate whatever observables I want. So now it's just a matter of turning the crank and just basically summing up all the diagrams. I'm interested in the low velocity limit. So if I look at these, so here's, for instance, the first diagram, the simplest diagram, where you have just two particles in the exchange of graviton. And just use ordinary Feynman rules, like you would use, like, I don't know, Pesson and Schroeder or something. You have to do them for gravity, but that's not so bad. It's kind of a pain, but it's not the end of the world. And then you get some number, and it's a product of two sources and a graviton propagator. And here's the leading term. Well, leading in what is the question? Because if I'm interested in the low velocity limit, this particular diagram has an infinite number of terms in the velocity expansion. Just from expanding out the fact that you're integrating over the proper times of each particle, the proper time is a function of velocity. The Feynman propagators are relativistic, so there's all kinds of retardation effects. If I'm expanding out a non-relativistic limit, it could show up there. So if you have a diagram like this, okay, fine. I'm interested in going out to b to the 6. I can just expand this out to whatever order I want. It's not the end of the world. It's fine for those diagrams, but what about a diagram like this one?
It's Feynman as opposed to retarded because it's...
It's because I'm calculating this. If I were to calculate something like h mu nu, you know, the expectation value of the graviton, then for that you would use a retarded property.
So it's a usual story that you've got the wave function of the vacuum. It's a vacuum.
Yeah, this I'm calculating S matrix elements. I'm calculating the vacuum to graviton amplitude. So that's why it's time ordered.
So the thing that you feed into the action, these XA are just to understand.
Yeah.
So you can feed how many as you want particles.
You could, yes. I'm interested in two.
Two, and you give them the position and the.
Arbitrary. I don't know what those positions are. I have to solve them. So I just give them arbitrary positions. I calculate a functional of arbitrary positions, and then I minimize that functional to get the actual positions. All right, so anyway, so you could do it for the one graviton exchange thing, you get a closed form answer. And you could expand to whatever order you like, but this, and all the diagrams is the usual relativistic covariant and Feynman rules. But if you actually, so that's great for that diagram, but if you look at a diagram like this one, it plays a role, it comes in at some order. What order? So I'm interested in going all the way out to order b to the 6, for example. What order do I have to go to? Do I have to keep this diagram or not? It's impossible to tell just from the expansion from the covariant Feynman rules I have so far. The reason is really because there's a whole bunch of scales running through this diagram all at the same time. So this is a relativistic graviton, so it's got. There's momentum flowing through this graph because these particles are sort of giving it momentum. And the momentum comes from all sorts of regions. It comes from regions where you have, it comes from all these different scales. And so the reason why these Feynman rules don't tell me what order and velocity something comes in. And so in a sense, I need to redo my Feynman rules to account for that.
But can I ask something?
Yeah.
You can emit a graviton by the same particle, but by the particle and absorb it by the same particle.
You could.
What happens to those?
What happens to those? Those things are, first of all, divergent.
Uh-huh.
Second of all, they're power divergent. They diverge like powers of some cutoff. Third of all, you can absorb them into the definitions of what you call the mass of the particle. So there's stuff like that all over the place, but. Uh-huh. But you basically can absorb it into a counterpart.
Why are they divergent? Because there's not really a loop there, right? Because it's the.
You're asking about graphs like this one.
Yeah.
Is that what you're asking about? Mm-hmm. So it's basically let's just do it in the limit where this is the particle just sitting there, the origin. And this will be like x one minus x two is x one. Just because they're, it's just like a Coulomb property. So it's linearly divergent.
It looks like a self-energy thing.
Yeah, it is a self-energy. Yeah, sure. I work in dimensional regularization, where there's no scales. So in my scheme, this is zero because there's no cutoff. There's no explicit cutoff. So, but what it is, it's just something that shifts the mass. So I wouldn't care anymore. It doesn't matter what kind of body it is. Like I just absorb it into what I call the mass, and then you measure the mass.
Right. What do you do with graviton loops?
They're there in the formalism, but they're way suppressed by, basically, they're suppressed by h bar over the angular momentum of the system, which is classical. So you can just not keep it.
When you move that point to spatial infinity, do you see some separate divergences?
There are eye divergences, and they can be dealt with. At the rate I'm going, I probably won't get to it. But I mean, if people are interested, I can certainly discuss them. That is part of what I want to talk about.
It must be more or less the effect of Hilbert story normally is if you're matching, then the infrared pieces on both sides will cancel. Is that what
happened? So the infrared in one is the UV in the other, and they cancel each other. But There are divergences actually here. Okay, can I maybe wait till later, or if I don't get to it, discuss it in private.
Well, that's just what I said. Photograph is not the normalizing. There's something that's suppression. Rabbits are active conversations closer to each other.
Sure.
So you can't just suppress it.
What's that?
What do you mean by suppressing?
Well, it just generates some term in the Einstein
around it. Is small.
Because you absorb it into a counter term,
it's a classical problem, so you don't have to
throw away anything border reach bar.
Loops
are border reach bar.
Yeah.
So then you'd have to keep things like curvature squares in the bulk that you didn't keep.
So you make them finite by that. It's always a local operator. So, I mean, everything's been normalized in the modern sense, not in the dimensionless enforced. But I mean, it's just a graviton loop with a divergence, which is correspond to some local operator. It would modify root GR by an R squared term. We don't know what the coefficient of that is, but presumably it's of order whatever M blank squared.
Let's say you're going to have quantum gravity people here.
Yeah. They think it's a big effect. All right. So anyway, so this the point is this graph has a bunch of different scales. Did we get it? And that's why this graph does not go like a definite power of velocity. So now I'm going to basically take Einstein gravity and mutilate, make it consistent with make it have a definite power count. And to do that, you have to realize that there's two kinds of modes moving inside of this graph. Modes that you might as well call potential because they're nearly instantaneous or in momentum space. They have a typical momentum of order. Of order whatever the size of the orbit, and then maybe suppressed in energy, and then these things have four momentum squared never equal to zero, so they're never on shell, and so you might as well just remove them, integrate them out, because they can never appear as external things, as actual physical radiation, which is always on shell, and for a non-relativistic problem, has momentum equal to energy. And these are the things you keep. So the goal now is basically to integrate out these modes, write down an effective Lagrangian for this. That effective Lagrangian will have manifest scaling and velocity, and then just calculate using that. So I'm basically out of time halfway through my talk. So I'm just going to go through this very quick, and we'll see how far we take it. So basically what I want to do is it's just the background field method. Treat the radiation as a background field for these potential modes. So they have, I don't know, they have support over different regions of either momentum space or wave vector space, whatever you want to call it. And so basically you just do the split, they have different regions of variation, and what you want to do is treat these as short distance modes in that long wavelength background and integrate these guys out. So basically, formally, this is what you do. There's a lot of technical stuff in here. You want to do it in a way that preserves the gauge invariance with respect to the background. So just add, it's a usual background field gauge for gravity. You do that, once you do that, you can define a propagator for these short distance modes. The propagator is purely instantaneous because they're basically potentials, and then you can assign scaling rules and velocity to that field. So it turns out to be, given how different things scale, it turns out to be something like that. It goes like velocity squared, and there's a factor of L, which is the orbital angular momentum of the system, and in my units where h bar is 1, even though h bar is 0. It's huge. It's a huge number. So you do that. You also have to do a couple of other things like multiple expanded radiation field. But once you do that, and I'm not going to go into any details, you have basically everything in the action scales like a definite power of velocity. And so therefore, any Feynman rule scales like a different power of velocity. So just to give you, so that was a busy slide, but just to give you a picture, these are the different rules associated with different vertices, and now it's just a matter of hooking up all these things together, and then you can just read off powers of velocity. So that's sort of what it looks like.
And the multiple expansion just in short version was you're creating the field point for some position of the source. And you have big X and little x. What was it?
Big X and little x?
You previous slide.
Yeah, so I'm expanding, let's say, about the center of mass of the system, for instance. You got to do that not just in the couplings of the particles, but also in the couplings of the in the Einstein Lagrangian. You have to do it there too. So anyway, you do that, and then you do that, and then you get, and then you basically integrate. You use those rules to integrate out the short distance potential gravitons, and then you get some functional of the radiation field, and it starts out with no factors of the radiation field, and that's just a point particle Lagrangian. Then you get a term with one factor of the radiation field, and you can write it in this way. And then you get more stuff, but for the classical problem, those are irrelevant. So these Siegel-type terms are irrelevant. You get a term like that, and because I set up the problem in a gauge-invariant way, this is some sort of conserved energy-momentum tensor, including both mechanical stuff, like the particles, and gravitational stuff, like the potentials. And then all these things have a well-defined Feynman diagram expansion in terms of Feynman rules that scale like velocity. And so let me just flash through that. And so, for instance, so here's the terms in the Lagrangian. So a leading order, you just get the Newton law from exchange graph. You also get the graph that you mentioned earlier. And for reasons that I mentioned earlier, too, it is zero in my regular scheme. So it is in three dimensions linearly divergent, but linear divergences you can throw away. They renormalize the mass of the particle. And so you do that, and of course you get Newton's law. You can keep playing this game at higher orders, and it's at the next order where you actually start really testing relativistic gravity, because it's where you first start seeing the interesting terms in the Einstein Lagrangian. So here are the terms, for instance, that make the perihelion of Mercury shift by whatever amount. And then you just put it all the terms together and you mix and match using the ordinary Feynman rules, and then you get some Lagrangian, and it looks something like that. And so this is actually, it's been known for some time, and that's what it is. And you can keep on playing this game to higher orders using our methods. I'm not discussing spin in this talk. For spinless particles, our methods have been used to go to fourth order. I'm sorry, yeah. So two more orders beyond V squared, V to the fourth. And our methods have also been used for spin effects, like spin precession, or spin orbit couplings and stuff like that, at the order V to the sixth.
What's N?
N? Oh, here?
Yeah.
I guess it's the unit vector between the two particles.
These CECB factors, they are not here?
They're not here. I'm just working with the point particle Lagrangians. They're way suppressed because the thing scales like radius to the 5. So basically that translates into a velocity to the 10th effect. So it's just kind of hopeless. All right, so that's that. We can talk about the one graviton sector, which is what gives you radiative effects, which is more interesting. And again, you can calculate them in an expansion in Feynman diagrams. And so at zeroth order, you just need to account for the fact that the particles radiate. And then if you want to go to a higher order, you can do so as well, but you have to realize that the power counting tells you that it's not only relativistic correction to the kinetic terms, but the potentials between the particles also generate radiation. And you just add up all the graphs, and all the graphs scale like powers of V. And if you multiple expand the field as well, you can read off all the moments from this T mu nu. So here's what all the moments look like. Everything's gauge invariant. Here's the interesting ones. Here's like couplings of the mass monopole, stuff like that. Not so interesting. But the gauge invariant couplings are given by this. So the leading order is an electric quadrupole. Then the next order of velocity is magnetic quadrupole and electric octupole, and so on. It's a lot like electromagnetic radiation. except that the moments have corrections to all orders of velocity. And just summing up all the graphs, here's what some of the moments look like. So the monopole moment is the sum of the masses plus a relativistic correction, which is just the Newtonian energy. You can calculate the center of mass, etc. The quadrupole moment we've done to order v to the 4, or v squared, beyond leading order. So to leading order is just the moment of inertia, and then there's relativistic corrections to that. And you can just keep going to whatever order you need. It gets harder and harder, but okay. And then finally, you can put all this stuff together and calculate this imaginary part of the action, which comes from basically we integrated out the heavy graviton, now we integrate out the light graviton, and that gives us an effective action that has an imaginary part whose cut generates the rate, and then you can just calculate that graph in terms of the moments, you get something like that. And you plug in, let's say, a circular orbit, and you get, and here's the first two terms. So everything works out. It's an agreement with standard results. Here's Einstein's quadruple formula. I'm not sure if Einstein came up with it first.
So what's the angle bracket? What was the average angle bracket?
This is a time average, actually. The one thing that shows up is the total time, sort of unphysical thing. The way you understand it is that you're really, the observables you're calculating are time average observables. So it shows up as a 1 over t times some interval. It's basically a delta function of 0 that you get. And that's how you think about it. So, okay, so that's bad to that order. It reproduces stuff that's known. And you keep going to a higher order. But you can also use this to calculate sort of what's more interesting is radiator corrections due to the nonlinear interactions with the outgoing radiation itself. And now that I integrated out the potential modes, I can do everything in this radiation Lagrangian. So it's just the thing I showed you, these couplings to these moments. The moments are known through the sort of short distance matching I did. Even if you don't know them, you can use this Lagrangian to calculate. They're just functions of time. And so you can just calculate graphs in that theory and obtain further corrections, but they're purely long distance corrections. For instance, you can calculate a correction to so to leading order, the graviton emission is from the quadrupole moment, which I'm calling Q here. And then at some order, there's an amplitude for a graviton to be emitted from the source to interact with the one over R field of the source itself, with the mass monopole of the source itself. You can just use the ordinary, just textbook Feynman rules to calculate an amplitude. You get something with two propagators in it. I'm only interested in the leading order effect, which is an interference effect. And you get a graph that looks like this. So you get a 1 over q squared from the Coulomb, from the 1 over r propagator, and you get the graviton propagator, the real graviton being emitted from the source. And we were discussing earlier infrared divergences, and here they are. This integral, if you let the momentum go to 0, diverges logarithmically. So I do the calculation of dimensional regularization, log divergences show up as poles. So that's what it is. That's the honest result. But it's a log divergence. And what is the meaning of a log divergence? It's actually not unprecedented. It's just the Coulomb divergence from quantum mechanical scattering. It's just the usual Coulomb distortion of the outgoing wave function. There, you're in quantum mechanics, you're used to electrons interacting with the 1 over r field. In gravity, gravitons are charged under the 1 over r field, so they also have these sort of Coulomb distortions. And even though you get the ultraviolet divergence in the amplitude, when you look at the interference term and you square up the amplitude, it's gone because it's a purely imaginary thing, and the real part is purely finite. And it leads to a correction to the power emitted. This is, by the way, in the literature it's called a tail effect for some reason. And what's interesting about it is that it's actually non-analytic in the velocity because it's a long-distance infrared effect. So that's where infrared divergences show up, but they go away when you calculate physical things. You can keep going. Why not? And let's just calculate, if we calculated this one, let's calculate one with two insertions. Well, let me just focus on the easiest thing to calculate, which is this graph is also IR divergent. Let me just keep the most IR divergent part of the graph. It actually, if this was the leading order, the thing I just showed you, the second thing looks just like that. And by induction, well, actually by real calculation, you can show that this whole series of ladder graphs exponentiates. And so all it does is that it takes a leading order quadruple amplitude and multiplies it by this factor. Actually, Weinberg way longer explained how this happens. Paper on IR photons and gravitons. So it's actually the same sort of thing.
What happens to the graphs where you have two gravitons from the same vertex?
So those are actually all order H bar. So you're asking about a graph like that? So sort of an element like that?
Well, or graviton, graviton, four graviton vertex in the case.
Oh, yeah, so stuff like this, right?
Yeah, well, the third guy will go, that.
Yeah, they're there too. So it's not a very systematic, well, it's systematic in the following sense. And it turns out it's not obvious. I don't completely remember how to explain it, but I'm in a sense, expanding to leading order in 1 over epsilon IR. So I'm expanding about d equals 4 minus epsilon dimensions. And I'm just keeping the most infrared divergent thing there is.
So they're there.
Those are there too.
They're not as infrared.
They're not as infrared divergent. And there's also interesting physics in some of these graphs.
Okay.
So at least the most infrared divergent part exponentially. That's one thing we're finding. It's not unprecedented that this happens. It sort of had to happen because it ensures that when you square up the amplitude, the Coulomb divergence is just a phase, so it squares up to something finite. And second of all, you kind of know that this had to happen because it basically, when you're doing this, it's basically as if you were calculating the outgoing graviton propagator in the 1 over r background. So basically, I'm just keeping a 1 over r potential. I showed you how that works out for the quadruple moments, but it happens for all the moments. It happens for any other moments I showed you. It's the same sort of diagram argument. In a sense, what's going on is that the quadruple moments that you measure at infinity they factorize into a short distance piece that you get by integrating out the potential modes, and a long distance piece that comes from the sort of Coulomb distortion. We can check this is right by using it to, well, not well to check the factorization is right, by using it to calculate, given the order v squared correction to the radiation, once I know that, and if I just replace the moments by this thing, I can obtain for free a v to the 5 correction to the radiation law, just from this sort of Coulomb distortion effect. So it actually, it's an old result, but it agrees with that, so it works out right. I get that just from I expand the exponential to do that. As far as I know, in the context of gravity waves, this sort of rigorous summation had not been noticed up to now. It's not particularly systematic in the velocity expansion because it's got an expansion in velocity. But it's interesting to at least to think about resumming that and at least sort of building a phenomenological model where you sort of keep that to sort of improve the series. People in this field love to do these sort of like Padé approximates and stuff like that. So you might ask yourself if you can use it for that. The answer is I don't know. It's not particularly systematic, but it is these exponentials are a big correction. given because it's basically because of this numerical 4 pi factor. There are big correction. So anyway, that's the sort of thing we can do with the long distance Lagrangian. You can also talk about ultraviolet divergences that show up in that Lagrangian and logs of the velocity. I don't have time for that. I'm way over time. I already talked about finite size effects. Let me just sort of close them by so this is the last of the things I want to say, or I have time to say. And as we discussed, they scale like the size of the 5. And so now that we have a power counting, we can figure out exactly how they come in to the calculations. So you can calculate, for instance, a correction to a potential due to this. And it's because of that size of the 5 scaling, it's way down. It goes like b to the 10. And so for a black hole, you'll never see this in a gravity wave detector. For larger objects like neutron stars, you might. And I think the conclusions are not so clean, and an attempt to do that was done by Flanagan, I think it's due to Flanagan. It might make some sort of a difference, at least for advanced light. I'm not going to say anything else. There's another class of finite size effects that I didn't even mention, which is the effects of spin. Spin classically is a finite size type object. And this spin has been taken into account in this sort of framework, and not by me, but mostly by Porto, a student of my collaborator Ross' team, and these two have done the hot sort of new results in spin due to interaction, black hole spin interactions or spin one effects, square stuff like that. So let me end there. I was going to talk about black hole absorption, but I seriously don't have time. And let me just summarize what I said, which is that these binary systems for gravitational waves are systems that can be usually treated using effective field theory methods, just because they have so many scales. And so I gave you for the last hour and 20 minutes some sort of flavor. Thanks for all the questions.
Well, I have one request. So I guess the thing I started, and I think it has to be related to what Andrew was asking in the beginning. Basically, you do expect like acceleration of the particle, so finite size effect, even if you are in a Minkowski background. You expect like things that like acceleration of the particle or higher order derivatives to enter.
Are you talking, we're talking about these extrinsic effects?
That's right, extrinsic, that's right.
Yeah. Okay, so what about acceleration? So here's one thing you can use. You can, anytime you see an acceleration term in the particle Lagrangian, you can basically redefine the axis, the coordinates, to remove that. You know, it's this sort of trick. You're always allowed to use the leading order equations of motion to simplify further terms in a Lagrangian. Mm-hmm. So formally they're there, but I mean, it's just this well-known lore where, you know, basically, if you have some higher order term in the size, you're always allowed to, if it vanishes by a leading order equation of motion, you're always allowed to drop it. And the reason is because you could have done a field redefinition of the variables, mm-hmm. where that term gets absorbed into some other term that doesn't involve itself.
Well, for a free particle, I mean, I that makes sense. But I mean, if there's an external field, this acceleration is not zero. So.
Yeah, so I'm talking, when I say acceleration, I mean the covariant. I mean, I'm talking about a linear geodesic equation. I mean, a mu, you know, everything's covariant.
But finite size particles don't follow geodesic.
That's right, and so that's what these operators, these e squared and b squared operators, that's why they measure how far from a geodesic they fall. But that's subleading in this expansion.
Okay.
So to leading order, you know, it's just to lead. So the gravitational field is long wavelength. So to leading order, it does follow a geodesic, and I'm allowed to use that to simplify the further term.
I had a question about, you mentioned the UV divergences.
Yes.
But so I would expect, like for that diagram, you're going to need to run on.
Yeah, so there's actually more interesting ones. And,
but that means from the start, you're starting, you're working with the effective mass. And you're going
So all those are always there. And power divergences are always around classically. And, you know, they're boring because they just get renormalized with the mass. But one of the ones I was I alluded to but didn't discuss, which is more interesting, is scattering off of the one. So a black hole has not only a 1/r potential, but a 1/r² potential. And when the outgoing graviton scatters off of that, that actually is, in this long distance theory, is ultraviolet divergence. So if you look at the integrals that I wrote down, the integral would be divergent not in the infrared, but in the UV. And what that actually is that it reflects a divergence, an infrared divergence in the multiple expansion. So what happens is that in the long distance theory, you have a UV divergence, and what can't, and so in a sense, what it renormalizes is the moments. And so there's a mu scale in there, and it's just can't, you know, our G scale, and it's just canceled by sort of an IR scale in the short distance.
So all the coupling in your multiple expansion.
Yeah, they have to be renormalized. But
you make some assumption about the structure of the mass. You can prove that if you sum up all three caps, you can swatch the solution.
Yeah, I have checked that explicitly out to where mass is.
Because it becomes a geometric series.
Yeah, you actually. I don't know if that's something I'm not sure anybody's actually done beyond.
Yes.
Oh, you done it? No, Duff does it to order mass squared.
This is,
if you look at that paper, he doesn't go beyond.
Physical review.
I know that paper. I probably haven't done one. He does not go beyond order m squared. I don't know. I assume you can use a very clever gauge for finding that. I don't remember him going beyond the order n squared. Maybe I'll look at it again. That's what I originally thought, and then I read the paper, and then I didn't see it.
The problem is, you know, you have to make assumptions about the mass. It's not a function.
I see. Okay. I'll look at it again.
Can you set these things up in some sort of an ideal formulation? I think people have done this. Because if you're going to be looking at infrared problems, that's usually the way that they just automatically exponentiate.
Yeah, so it might just be a reflection of that. It's most likely just a reflection of that.
I mean, they all exponentiate. You never have to really look at just adding Feynman graphs. Feynman graphs are a terrible way to go about solving infrared problems.
Right.
But I mean, I thought people had.
So in this case, the way you would do it with that Feynman graphs is that you wouldn't use the flat space propagator for the graviton. You would use the propagator in the background, and then you would see it.
But it should be a very compact way of getting out anything that looks like. Well, no bar physics anyway.
Yeah. We didn't do it that way. We did it in brute force. But...
Okay, that's fine. Okay.